Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, September 9th, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we'll be discussing empty suit litigation. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, we're recording this call for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome to our call today our expert, Mr. Victor E. Schwartz. He's a partner at Shook, Hardy & Bacon, a law firm right here in Washington, D.C. He's going to give us some opening remarks of about 10 to 12, perhaps 15 minutes, talking about empty suit litigation. After that, we're going to open the floor to questions, so please do be thinking about the questions you'd ask our guest today. With that, Mr. Schwartz, the floor is yours.
Hey, thank you, Dean, very much, and thank all of you who are listening to this. Empty suit litigation is a term that I derived to focus on a development in liability law, and some of you know I write this case book, I think they call it Schwartz on Torts. So I've been interested in tort law and its varieties for many years. But empty suit litigation, the core of it, is that the person who is bringing a claim, be it an individual claim, be it for personal injury, be it for economic loss, has no real harm as a cab driver would see it, or somebody who works in Subway would see it, or any regular person would see it. They're not injured. And it also, empty suit litigation, flows into the area of class actions, and I'll discuss that in a moment. So you have a word or words that are describing something that has a common theme, but all are very different. A friend, a plaintiff's lawyer, a real smart one, said this: if I can make a living by people who are injured, I can do really well. But if I'm able to bring claims when people are not injured, I can make a fortune. My income may be endless. And he spoke the truth. Very recently, the Supreme Court of Ohio recognized empty suit litigation in a case called Felix versus Ganley Chevrolet. That was a class action brought by lead plaintiffs who had arguably suffered a harm. An arbitration agreement was used with them that was not lawful. But there were thousands who were included in the class that had no injury whatsoever. Nevertheless, under the Ohio's Consumer Protection Act, a lower court awarded every person in the class $200. When it went to a mid-level appeal case, the appellate court affirmed. On August 27th, the Supreme Court of Ohio ruled that the class was to be dismissed, a 6-1 ruling. And it's a good case to look at, Gangley. You can find it on the internet, because that was the first time a court was so clear, so crystal clear, that our legal system should not be used for people who have no injury. Let me briefly go through the variety that falls under this rainbow of empty suit litigation. Some are personal injuries, and for those of you who are lawyers or those of you who have not, know that our legal system will allow claims for negligent infliction of emotional harm. Originally, somebody had to have some contact with the defendant. But then the law changed and said, you can have a claim for negligent infliction of emotional harm if there is some objective manifestation of injury. But what about 2015? The American Law Institute and the Restatement of Torts III and some claims have pushed for emotional harm claims where the essence of it is a person testifies how emotionally harmed they were. Like, I think Mrs. Clinton yesterday started to cry. They start crying on the stand. There is no objective symptomatology. That is empty suit litigation. But there's more. The Supreme Court of Minnesota a few years ago ruled that people could recover damages where they weren't harmed at all, but they could have an expert testify that if a person had gone to a different doctor, their probability of recovery would be higher. So with Dr. A, their probability of recovery would be 40%. With Dr. B, it would be 60%. And therefore, the person should be rewarded. Now, think about medical malpractice costs now. Again, be clear. If this person became injured, if they died, a claim would be allowed. This is just allowing a claim because an expert will testify that there was an increased risk of injury. We think that's empty suit litigation and shouldn't be recognized. The same is really true with claims for medical monitoring. Here you have a plaintiff who, and it's usually a class action, who have nothing wrong with them right now. But they say, if we can get money for medical monitoring, maybe we won't die. Maybe we will live longer. But here's the problem. Two of the courts that have recognized it, the Supreme Court of Missouri and the Supreme Court of West Virginia, have allowed money to flow to these plaintiffs, even though there's no showing that medical monitoring will help them, or that the money will ever be used for medical monitoring at all. A dissenting judge in West Virginia said, well, they could use it to buy a pickup truck. That, too, is empty suit litigation. We all know about product liability. If a car or other lawnmower is defective and you can prove that the defendant defectively designed the product or failed to properly warn, a recovery can be allowed. But suppose somebody has a product that has no defect whatsoever, but somebody else has a product that did have a problem. This has occurred with automobiles, it's occurred with drugs. And the claim is, even though there was nothing wrong with my product might be worth less because there was that harm, because there was that recall. Highly speculative in nature. Most courts have rejected it. All the cases are class actions, but it's empty suit litigation. Money is being transferred to people who are not injured, and we all know there's a limited supply of money with any particular defendant. In fact, skipping back to medical monitoring for a moment, the Supreme Court expressly rejected medical monitoring in a case arising under federal law because the money was needed for victims. That was an asbestos case. There have been cases brought where plaintiffs, a few, claimed a washing machine resulted in their laundry not smelling good. If that's true and it's defective, they should be awarded. But in the class were hundreds of people where there was no showing that they suffered any harm or there was anything wrong with their washing machine. We regard that as empty suit litigation. Almost all states have consumer protection acts. Consumer protection acts are there to prevent fraud, to prevent deceptive practices, saying that this cloth can clean anything crystal clear and it can't, and somebody buys the cloth, and they've suffered an economic loss, and they deserve to be paid. But suppose the person never bought the cloth or never saw the advertisement. Should they be paid? In other words, they really didn't suffer an injury. We see that also as empty suit litigation. Some of it has arisen by how courts construe a Consumer Protection Act. We are thankful that the Supreme Court of Ohio said, no, you have to have suffered a real injury. Dean, I think I'll stop there and take questions. I think that gives people a reasonable overview, at least I hope it does.
Terrific. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for our expert, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert, Mr. Victor Schwartz, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open at this point if you want to be the first person with a question. Let me start by, while we wait to see if anyone rings in here, by making a quick commercial announcement about upcoming Teleforum conference calls. Tomorrow is our next scheduled Teleforum call at 12:30. We'll be debating, not just discussing, but debating birthright citizenship with John Yu and John Eastman, two law school professors who have opposing views on the issue. That's tomorrow at 12:30 Eastern Time. Today, of course, we're talking about empty suit litigation. Our guest is Mr. Victor Schwartz. And let me ask you, how is the case and controversy requirement and the standing requirement met in the classic empty suit litigation cases when there is no injury? Is that the method used to bounce these cases out of courts by the courts that do bounce them out?
Some courts have gone to standing as a issue, not a lot, but some have, saying you don't have standing to sue if you're not injured. There's a case that's going to the Supreme Court involving Tyson's Food and the Wage and Labor Act, where employees in a class have brought a suit for being compensated for time when they took off and put on protective wear. But there was no showing that everybody in the class was deprived of wages for that time. So a lower court allowed a claim saying we're going to use a statistical average of what it might be of time lost and time not paid. There, a standing argument is being used to the Supreme Court as to whether or not standing should be allowed where individuals are not shown to endure specific harm. I haven't seen, that doesn't mean it doesn't exist, the case and controversy argument used with respect to stopping empty suit litigation.
Interesting. If you're in the audience, you have a question for our guest, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got two questions lined up at this point, so let's take our first call of the day. Caller, you might have your telephone line muted. We're trying to reach a caller with area code 304.
I'm sorry, yeah, that's me.
Okay, go right ahead, sir. We can hear you.
I apologize, Dean. This is Luke Laffery in West Virginia, as it happens. And I'm just curious to what extent you think that this approach to, you know, letting empty suit litigation go on will spread across the country in the future.
Well, the West Virginia case of Bauer against Westinghouse was rendered in 1999. The only state court that followed it was the Supreme Court of Missouri. So Bauer didn't travel that much. Most courts have rejected medical monitoring because they believe that a court is not structured to assure that the money is used for medical monitoring purposes. So Bauer didn't travel well from West Virginia other than to Missouri, which rendered a decision that was as open-ended. In a few courts that adopted medical monitoring, such as the Supreme Court of Maryland, they did try to put some brakes or limits and create a fund for medical monitoring and to be used for that purpose. So far that hasn't happened. My understanding is that it may be in West Virginia at some point legislation might be introduced to put some limits on the Bauer decision.
I can see that happening since we've got the first Republican legislature since the Great Depression. But
last year there was more, I think there was a gentleman named Greg Thomas down there,
yep,
who did a heroic job in West Virginia of getting through some fundamental civil justice reforms. And it was a dramatic change. It was dramatic. People didn't think that it could ever occur. And I've been to West Virginia many times. It's a great state. It has good things to export. Fortunately, it hasn't exported its case law much. But it's not a matter of radical change, just a few things that can be modified so that business is attracted to what I think is a great state. I've always had a very good, pleasant time visiting there.
Thank you.
One of the greatest characters I've ever met was from West Virginia. His name was Chief Justice Neely. And he was the youngest Chief Justice in the history of the state. And he was one of the greatest characters I've ever met. He's still alive and well.
And he's a plaintiff's lawyer.
Oh, absolutely.
All right,
speaking, this is Dean Reuter. Speaking of characters, Victor, we don't get a lot of people on our calls who do impressions, but I know you do. You're kind of famous here in Washington. Most of our callers today are from outside the Beltway, so they probably don't know you do impressions. But you're credited with coining the term empty suit litigation, as well as the term judicial hellholes, which I think a lot of people have heard. The empty suit litigation, that term is it's visual, it's very descriptive. I think it's intuitively obvious what you're talking about when you bring it up. But I want to ask you if you would indulge us by letting us know what President Clinton might, I know that's one of the impressions you do, what he might have to say about
it. Now, this is not an impression. I'm in his office right now. I just stopped in. You know, there Schwartz goes again with these things like empty suit. We are a full suit crew. Hillary and I are going to go around this nation. No empty suit litigation. I promise that to every American. We will end it, except where people are not injured. Then we will allow it. I promise.
Okay, that's an interesting platform. We still have Victor Schwartz on the line, I'm told, so we're taking audience questions. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one caller lined up right now. Let's take another call.
Dean, this is Charles Miller from Cincinnati, and I've got a question specifically regarding last month's Felix decision. Is that... from this empty suit perspective, is that now decided, or is there a potential for that to seek cert?
We don't know whether they'll – we don't see a federal question there for them to seek cert. I mean, for the go to the Supreme Court of the United States, they would need a federal question, and there was no federal question before the court. It was a matter of interpreting Ohio law, and I'm so glad to get a call from Cincinnati. Do you know that I lived there for some period of time?
I did not know that.
And I was dean of the law school there.
How about that?
It was my favorite place to live. I loved it. You could walk to the ballpark. You could go to the music hall for a very modest amount of fee. And it was part of the best time of my life. And I still... I'm active with the University of Cincinnati. They've set up a torts chair in my name. I don't deserve it, believe me. But it just brings back only good memories. It was a terrific city to live. But
I enjoyed my time here. It's a nice small, big city.
Everything is accessible. But I'm a member of the Ohio Bar. And so when we filed our amicus brief, there was a bar number, and it's my bar number. It's a low number. So it probably was good to do that. And Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor wrote a really well-crafted opinion. A lot of time was probably spent with that, and everybody should read it. And actually, it tells you a way to help stop empty suit litigation. When it arises and there is an issue, for those of you who are listening, it is important to have some amicus help because the parties have to focus on the specific issue in the case, where the amicus brief can bring the empty suit litigation picture to the court so they can see the total picture of what it's part of and are more inclined to reject it. We have thought about legislative solutions. People are thinking about that. But to date, the best way to close it down is to really bring the picture to the court. Also, and Dean has told you all, but online we have a Law Review article that just was published by the Brooklyn Law Review in 80 Brooklyn Law 599 called The Rise of Empty Suit Litigation. We trademarked it. Where should tort law draw the line? And if you should have a case where you need it, you want to do further research on it, it was done with my colleague, Carrie Silverman, who's ever so much brighter than I am. And it's not like the Sleepy Law Review article, which can put almost anybody to sleep without Ambien. It tries to use language that judges will like and appreciate. They may not be persuaded by it, but it might save people time for research. Brooklyn Law Review, Empty Suit Litigation. It was just published, and it's online.
We've got a couple more questions pending, three more questions pending. The article that Mr. Schwartz mentions is in the notice of today's call that you received by email. There's also a link to it on the Federalist Society's website under our teleforum page. But let's continue on with our caller who got, as I say, three questions pending. Let's take another call.
Hello, Professor Schwartz. This is William Large in Tallahassee, Florida. My question concerns the settlements of a lot of this empty suit litigation. How is there a way to assess the number of people who have actually redeemed coupons or sought some type of benefit from the litigation? For example, the Red Bull Gives You Wings litigation, where people claim that that was misleading. Is there any way to determine how many people actually asked for a refund of Red Bull or sought a coupon? And if so, what are the numbers of actual citizens and consumers seeking rebates from these alleged wrongs?
Mr. Large is a great person on civil justice reform in Florida, just heroic accomplishments for those of you who are online in a state that has its challenges. There have been some studies, Mr. Large, and I don't have them right in front of me, but overall, the redemptions are low, and I'm cautious about the settlements. Our article talks about some of the settlements where maybe there should not have been a settlement. There have been settlements of cases where the law is just not there, but because people settled, I know this is not a direct answer, it entices other cases. If you have two roaches in your kitchen and they're on a table, and you put out two lumps of sugar, they might eat the sugar and go away. But do you think they'll be back, and will they bring some relatives with them? That's what happens when empty suit litigation is settled. From what we know, and I will look up and give Dean some information after the call, the studies that are around, most people do not redeem. If it's $10 or $15, they don't take the time to do it. It's too much paper. And then there's a bunch of money left. And what happens to that? And that is a whole different issue for another forum. But it doesn't always go where it should. It virtually never goes back to the company. And so your question opened up some things, and I regret I do not have a study right in front of me that would satisfy your question. I will try to find that information and give it to Dean.
Again, if you have a question, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got two more questions pending, so let's carry on.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. John Lewis here, calling from Jackson, Mississippi. If I'm understanding this discussion correctly, most of these empty suit claims are brought under state law. This is an area of law that is sort of new to me, so forgive me if I'm misunderstanding some things. With regard to federal questions, specifically, I'm thinking back to some prior Federalist Society broadcasts about the Consumer Protection Board, SFPB, and how the CFPB is trying to calculate, make a statistical calculation of potentially injured parties. That circumstance had to do with consumer loans for automobiles, I believe. So I guess the crux of my question is, are these empty suit states normally always brought under state law claims, or what sort of federal issues might we have here?
Almost all of them. Thank you for your question. Almost all of them are brought under state tort law or state consumer protection acts.
Okay.
On occasion, there may be a federal law, and the wage and hour law is the one in Tyson's food case that you can look it up on the internet, that's going to the Supreme Court. But if the Supreme Court rules that there is no claim, it will be under federal law and the federal rules of civil procedure. So it can stand as something for other courts to look at, but the court will not be acting under its constitutional power. It will simply be acting under its power in interpreting a federal law. But that's unusual. The claims for medical monitoring, the claims for Consumer Protection Act, the claims for emotional harm, the claims for increased risk, some of the ones that I went through, all arise under state tort law or state statutes. Once in a while, you can have one under federal law. The Supreme Court's ruling against medical monitoring arose under something called the Federal Employers Liability Act, a misnamed statute because it has nothing to do with federal employers. FELA, as it's known, is the law that governs compensation to people who are injured as employees on railroads. And a claim was brought for people who worried that they might get sick from asbestos in the future. The court ruled in a case called Buckley, a very well-written opinion, that there would be no recovery. But that precedent is there for states to look at, but it doesn't have the power of a constitutional decision. It was the Supreme Court interpreting a federal law. I probably told you more than you want to know, but I hope at least I've answered your question.
No, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
I wonder, Victor, this is Dean Reuter again. Some of these cases, there are settlement pools, so there's a finite amount of money that's available to pay out to plaintiffs of a class. Is there any splitting within the ranks of the trial bar or among the plaintiffs when it comes to dividing that pool between people who have proven injuries and those who have speculative or no injuries?
One of the, I think, extreme powers of plaintiffs' lawyers that in some states has been curbed a bit is that they really get to decide who gets what. Now, there's been some change in some states so that people who are really injured get substantial amounts of money. But it is an area of law that in some states is open to use or arguably abuse of power. But there's been corrective measure. There is no chart, so to speak, and still a great deal of power lies in the men and women who are the attorneys for class actions. But a good trend recently has been for judges to supervise the settlement and help assure that people who are really injured get paid more money than an empty suit litigation person is paid. There's a kind of strange sort of helping each other out that the plaintiff's lawyers figure, because if they can put in the lead people who are really injured, there's empathy for people like that. But they get better numbers if they can make it into a class. So that gives them leverage for settlement. So there's still a lot of discretion, but recent trends have been for judicial supervision to assure that people who are really injured are paid more. Yet there are no real strict barriers on who gets paid what.
We've got just one question from our audience pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. But for now, let's take another call.
Hi, Victor. This is Corey Andrews calling from Washington Legal Foundation.
Yes, sir.
Good afternoon. As you know, in addition to the Tyson's Food case, the Supreme Court granted cert in Spokio v. Robbins. The issue in that case is, although there's a technical bare violation of the statute, the plaintiffs don't appear to have suffered any concrete particularized harm under Article 3. Is that a species of empty suit litigation as well, or is that a different animal altogether in your estimation?
Just expand on a little bit about what the details of that case are. Corey, thank you for your question.
Sure, absolutely. Well, the court twice earlier had granted review but was unable to reach the question of whether Congress, by conferring so-called statutory standing, which again is provides a cause of action where a statute is violated, whether that suffices to satisfy Article 3. So in the Spokio case, Spokio had a people search engine that aggregated publicly available data about an individual. The individual Robbins sued Spokio because he claimed they violated the Fair Credit Reporting Act. However, his allegations at the district court level were bounced because they didn't really allege any concrete particularized harm. In particular, what he said that Spokio did was that they represented him more favorably than he otherwise was, that he was said to have had more education than he has, that he was said to have a greater financial wealth than he has. But nevertheless, this seems to fall within the strict technical definition of a statutory violation. And so the question the court is going to decide, we hope this time, is whether, because Congress says something is actionable, whether that suffices Article 3 standing requirement.
I think that is somewhat of a unique federal issue. There might be language in an opinion that's favorable that could be helpful in other contexts, but it isn't in the mainstream of what we call empty suit litigation. But your question allows me to mention one point, and that is sometimes when there's empty suit regulation, and an article shows it, there is a regulatory body that's there to act, even though there is no harm. And they have the responsibility to come in before there's harm. And there's nothing wrong with that. The Consumer Product Safety Commission can act on product defect even though nobody has yet been injured. And we believe and say in the article, when there is a regulatory body that addresses a specific issue and somebody has not been injured, it's not the place of tort law to come in and allow a claim to somebody who's not been hurt. But the case you raise, and I'm glad you did, Corey, you write great stuff, is not one that I think has overarching affect on the general problem of empty suit litigation.
Let me make another call for questions. We've got nobody on the line with a question pending. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let me ask you another question, if I could. This goes to the class actions incentive, so this might be broader than just empty suit litigation. But we've talked before on some of these calls and in some of the Federalist Society literature about the incentives in class action litigation. The plaintiff's attorneys, of course, are wanting a settlement with a large amount of money as possible. Their self-interested incentives might be to get their clients coupons and get themselves a monetary award. At the same time, the defense lawyers and maybe the defending company might have a stronger interest in paying out half the amount it could, and it cares little whether that money goes to the attorneys, the plaintiff's attorneys, or to the settlement class. They just want to get out as cheaply as possible and probably as quickly as possible to get it off their books. At the same time, the court wants to clear cases off its docket. You mentioned a couple minutes ago that judges are getting better at shepherding cases and making sure payments go to injured parties only. Are courts, you know, in the past, whatever period of time you want to pick, are they getting better, by and large, at policing class action litigation more generally and making sure that cases are settled only in sensible ways that serve the plaintiffs rather than the plaintiff's bar or even in some cases the defendant corporation?
There's a number of decisions where judges have, but I couldn't mention the decisions without mentioning the name of a fellow named Ted Frank, who you can look up. He has an organization, and he's been one to represent his view of what is the public interest, even though both plaintiffs and defendants have decided to settle with money going principally to the plaintiff's lawyers. And he's been able to make some good law. I'm sure you can Google him and see the cases he has won over the past 5 years where the issue you raised has been addressed. Prior to that, it wasn't addressed much because there wasn't anybody to address it. The defendants signed the settlement agreement, the plaintiff's lawyers agreed to it, and their fees were calculated on things that, in a way, were surreal. Some want a reform, and the plaintiff's lawyers won't like this, but some of the defendants won't like it, to make fees based not on the amount of settlement, and getting back to Mr. Large's question, the amount that's actually redeemed. So if there's a $10 million settlement and a fund set up, and only $10,000 of the fund is used, then the lawyer's fee would come out of the $10,000, not the $10 million. And that's a tough reform. But there are those who have thought about that as a way of discouraging the type of settlement you're talking about. I'm not endorsing the reform or again it, but just to describe it.
Let me make then a final call for questions. If you have a question, we've still got some time left. Push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. I don't see any further questions. Do you have another impression that you could share with us?
You have to ask me as somebody.
Let me ask a question.
Ask Charlie Rangel a question. Ask Clinton a question. I can't just do it in the abstract. Let me ask then
President Reagan about the naming of the airport. There's a Reagan National Airport here in Washington, D.C. There's been some talk already about changing the name of the airport. Let me see if there's an opinion or a response to that.
You know, I heard about that the other day, and it troubled me. I didn't ask that airport be named after me. Well, they're doing all sorts of things. They're changing Mount McKinley to Mount something else. I can't even pronounce it. They're talking about taking Andrew Jackson off the $20 bill. And now, the height of, I think, impropriety, taking my name off that airport. And I hope those, well, maybe a few Democrats, won't pursue that anymore.
Well, it's good to hear from you. If we can talk to Victor Schwartz again, let me see if you have any final thoughts before we close out the call.
No, but this is the final thought. I think that the Federalist Society, by putting light on empty suit litigation, can make it go away. What I've seen in my career in civil justice is light brings about correction, and sometimes labels, the way judicial hells helped change some judges from being unfair to being open-ended. Judge from Philadelphia, a prominent judge, wrote the people who make judicial hellholes that he was going to improve the way class actions were working in that country, in that city, Philadelphia. A judge in Mississippi, where a county was named as a hellhole, said, when I came home and my son Todd said, why are you working in a judicial hellhole? I changed my ways. So we hope through publicity such as you're providing to empty suit litigation, it will encourage companies not to settle empty suit litigation. It will encourage them to fight. We hope it will encourage amicus briefs, because to the ordinary person, ask a cab driver, ask a person who works at Subway, they think this type of lawsuit is meaningless. They don't even know why it occurs. And it does take away money. There's a limited supply for people who are really injured. So this is not a pro-plaintiff or a pro-defendant issue. It's a societal issue, and I appreciate your giving me the time to discuss it with your members.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Schwartz. Again, to our audience, the article we've been talking about, The Rise of Empty Suit Litigation, Where Should Tort Law Draw the Line? A link to that article is in the notice of today's call. You got also on the Federalist Society's website. I want to thank our audience for dialing in and for your thoughtful questions. A reminder that our next scheduled teleforum conference call is tomorrow at the special start time of 12:30 Eastern. We'll be debating birthright citizenship. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.